Cyclone Idai's massive impact today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Cyclone Idai hit Mozambique and Zimbabwe days ago, but the impact was so severe, help is only now reaching people there.
They have no food. Some of them don't have shelter. They don't know where they're going to sleep tonight.
Also, Sudanese-American teens are energized by the Sudan protests they're following on social media.
I would grab my phone and I'd be like 8 o'clock in the morning, running to my friends, like, look at what my people do, and it's in Arabic, and they're like, what are they even saying? And I like explain to them. That made me feel like this is my home.
Plus, a change in work visas for Filipinos leaves U.S. small businesses in a jam. And feeling bad about yourself? Chinese social media has a solution.
I paid $7.50 to be praised for 5 minutes.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Oceans where they should not be. It's happening in the Midwest, where the Missouri River has burst its banks. Looking at the devastation from the air, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds said the floodwaters look like an ocean. And it's also what's happening in southern Africa after a cyclone hit there last week. Cyclone Idai hit Mozambique and eastern Zimbabwe the hardest. We begin today on the ground in Mozambique to get an idea of what's going on. The BBC's Pumza Fishani is in Beira, a city on the Indian Ocean that's home to more than 500,000 people.
We drive through what remains of the city. The first sign of destruction, a school. From the outside, now only a shell. Inside, the desks are splintered into pieces and classroom floors flooded. In another part of town, some people are trying to salvage what they can.
Everyone we come across now is begging us to go into their homes. They want to show us what's happened. We're the first people they've seen since the cyclone hit. They tell me they have no food. Some of them don't have shelter. They don't know where they're going to sleep tonight.
It is still early days, but a grim picture of the scale of this disaster is emerging. Many are still unaccounted for. Many are still waiting to be saved, clinging to the hope that someone will find them.
The BBC's Pumza Fishani reporting from Beira in Mozambique. I also want you to hear the voice of one resident there. His name is Wilker de Assis de Souza Dias. And he told the BBC that his city is almost unrecognizable after the storm.
The cyclone was picking up everything in its path. It was just destroying everything. I would say that from what I've seen, 75% of the city is totally destroyed. We're still waiting for assistance to arrive. We need food, certainly, and we urgently need construction materials.
Wilker is his name. He's a resident of the devastated city of Beira in Mozambique. Eastern Zimbabwe was also hammered by Cyclone Idai's heavy rains and violent winds, so much so that one district there called Chimanimani is now completely cut off from the outside world.
Both cell tower repeaters ran out of fuel for their generators, so there actually has been little to no contact with those communities, so we haven't heard anything from those stranded in Chimanimani.
That's Paolo Chernuski. He heads the International Rescue Committee's office in Harare, Zimbabwe.
The cyclone brought record rains in 48 hours. Two of the districts that have been most affected are, for the most part, still inaccessible, and many of the communities that are in those two districts have not been reached yet by assistance or aid because roads are destroyed, bridges are destroyed.
So we're seeing photographs of the tops of what seem to be tall trees just peeking out of the water, trucks on the road submerged in mud, people covered in mud. How do you begin to get a grip on the human cost of this tragedy?
All our focus right now is to try and get immediate life-saving assistance and support into those districts for the most affected communities. We're talking about food, water, blankets, water purification tablets, before we even try to quantify what the long-term reconstruction efforts will need to look like.
How are you getting supplies through? Like, what is your plan right now?
As of earlier today, a certain number of helicopters by the Zimbabwe National Army were deployed, and they were able to fly today for the first time, so they have managed to airlift certain supplies to some communities.
I mean, Zimbabwe is kind of getting through some growing pains with the transition out of the years of the Mugabe regime. Is their government positioned to work on this with some energy right now?
There's certainly a sense of urgency by the humanitarian community and local government as well. So resources are being put behind it, physical assets like the choppers, but also actual men on the ground and financial resources by the Zim government. So I think that definitely there is an effort to be as responsive and as coordinated as possible in this humanitarian response.
Paolo, how are aid groups like yours, the IRC, dealing with the increasing intensity of storms all over the world? Are you building that into your calculus for response?
So us and the humanitarian community as a whole, we definitely have been trying to work on what we call resilience programming. So to really look not just at the humanitarian response, but what can be done beforehand to help communities be better prepared when disasters hit. But more importantly, when we talk about the now constant climate change and what that brings, increasing drought, extended dry spells, lower rainfall patterns, livelihoods and the way communities deal with them has to change to reflect that. And an IRC in Zimbabwe is an implementer of the Zimbabwe Resilience Building Fund is one of the organizations that's leading on that to try and work with communities to diversify livelihoods and adopt a number of strategies to make them more resilient to what is basically almost a constant now of climate-induced shocks and stresses.
I'm struck by how hard it is, as you said, to get accurate reports from the hard-hit areas from Cyclone Idai. I mean, there was a headline that dropped last Thursday about this cyclone, and then it seems like no news for several days. Why did it take so long for even the basic details? Is it just a story about infrastructure?
Certainly, the original forecasts, the earlier forecasts of the rainfall levels and the damage that will bring in Zimbabwe were much, much lower. So I do wonder whether it only registered with the global consciousness, if you wish, once it became clear what the scope of the damage really was, which at the beginning it really wasn't.
Presumably the IRC in Zimbabwe has a number of Zimbabwean employees. How are they coping with all this? Because they must come from some of these areas that have been hard hit.
It certainly isn't easy. We unfortunately had one of our staff members who lost immediate family in some of the floods. So everyone right now is very much in emergency response mode. The top priority is getting assistance to those that need it the most. But, certainly the stress of dealing with what has happened and the damage and also the impact that this will have long term on Zimbabwe is a lingering thought at the back of everyone's mind and probably suppressed by the effort that everyone's putting in the emergency response right now. It's not easy.
Well, we wish you all the best of luck in reaching the people most impacted by this flood. Paolo Chernuski, the country director for the International Rescue Committee in Zimbabwe, speaking with us from Harare. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Luxembourg is one of Europe's smallest countries. It's roughly the size of Rhode Island, nestled between Belgium, Germany, and France. But this tiny nation has a big problem, traffic. So it's doing something no other country ever has, making all public transportation free. Sounds like a great idea, but is it?
I don't think that there is a great potential for people to change their behavior as a result of making public transport free in Luxembourg.
Oded Katz is among the skeptics. He studies transportation at Delft University of Technology in the Netherlands, and he says there are cities and towns around the world experimenting with this. Estonia's capital, Tallinn, for example, it made public transit free for residents back in 2013. The results? Not so great, says Katz. People who were biking, walking, or already using public transit are using it more.
But we don't see any reduction in car traffic, and therefore we cannot also expect any change in emissions, unfortunately.
I mean, do you understand that? Because I don't. If I were offered free public transportation, I think I'd be using it a lot more. And I have a car. I mean, I know the benefits of car transportation in a city like Boston where you need a car.
There are specific groups for them the price does make a difference.
What primarily, kind of user groups?
Primarily the unemployed and low-income groups. At the same time, it's very seldom the case that one doesn't use public transport because it's too expensive compared to the car. So there are two things you can do to attract people to use public transport. One is to make the cost of using the car more expensive. And I emphasize using the car, not owning a car, pricing measures, congestion charging. And secondly, making public transport more attractive. So improve the level of service by increasing frequency and reliability primarily.
So you mentioned Tallinn, the Estonian capital. What cities have you looked at where they have eliminated any fee for riding public transport? And what have you seen there?
So we have so far we have quite a limited experience internationally. There are very few cases where we have mid-size or larger cities that introduce this. Tallinn being the most interesting example. It's about 500,000 residents, and basically what makes it difficult is for these to become financially sustainable. So public transport systems worldwide, they have two main sources of income. One being subsidies, taxpayers' money, and the other being ticket revenues. So in Tallinn, you must register as resident of Tallinn for you to be eligible for free ride. Mm. And there were about 30,000 people that lived in Tallinn, but were not registered as residents. And this was an incentive, basically, for them to register. And once they're registered, they pay municipal tax. So the additional revenues from this municipal tax for those people that now newly registered covers for the lost ticket revenues.
So when this plan goes into effect in Luxembourg, who's going to be able to get on and off the buses and trains for free? Just citizens? Because with the whole Benelux, Belgium, Netherlands, Luxembourg, you've got a lot of people coming in just to work for the day, right?
Indeed, very good point. So in Luxembourg, about 50% of people actually are commuters from neighboring countries, primarily Germany, France, and Belgium. And that is an interesting challenge because it will only be free in the Luxembourgian part of your trip. So if you take a trip, let's say a train trip from Germany or France, they will still have to pay for this ride.
I mean, Luxembourg is one of the wealthiest countries in the world. Ultimately, isn't that the reason you're actually able to try this out in the first place? I mean, could you imagine this happening in a less wealthy country?
No, that is indeed the case. So Luxembourg can afford it. It's also the case that the subsidy level for public transport is already fairly high. It has very limited rural or suburban area where public transport is less efficient. So for all these reasons, this becomes a place where you can afford introducing this. At the same time, I don't think that there is a great potential for people to change their behavior as a result of making public transport free in Luxembourg.
Ode Katz, a professor focusing on transportation and planning at Delft University of Technology in the Netherlands. Thanks very much.
Pleasure. Thank you.
A note now about someone you've heard on the show before, Canadian Lily Singh. The World's Rupa Shenoy told us about her. Singh was once a depressed college graduate, didn't know what she wanted to do with her life, and then she started dressing up as her Punjabi parents and making YouTube videos.
She thinks she cool, she got so many views. She on TV every day on the news, but they only watch for me now, ain't that the truth? That's why they ask about your mommy, daddy in interviews.
Singh built a following of nearly 15 million subscribers and became one of the highest paid YouTube stars. Her comedy was often about being Indian or being an immigrant or a kid of an immigrant. She told Rupa she wouldn't have gotten famous if YouTube didn't exist, if she had to break into Hollywood the way other people do, by going to casting calls.
In the digital space, people consider me a star, but then I go into auditions and they'll be like, sorry, what was your name again? And so I kind of feel like I'm living a split life trying to climb two different ladders, and I'm at very different rungs on each ladder.
Now, that's changed.
I do have an announcement, and that is that your girl is getting her own NBC late night show!
She made the announcement on Jimmy Fallon. Her new show will be called A Little Late with Lily Singh, and she's thanking her followers on YouTube for making it happen.
An Indian-Canadian woman with a late-night talk show? I would not be here without you.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau tweeted his congratulations. He told Singh she was making Canada proud. Singh tweeted back, "Thank you, Prime Minister. Please find a way to send me ice caps and Timbits while shooting." Translation for people who don't speak Canadian, ice caps, that's like Frappuccino, and Timbits are donut holes. Didn't think you'd be in charge of the craft service table, did you, Mr. Prime Minister? A Little Late with Lily Singh is scheduled to debut in the fall on NBC. Coming up, a change in U.S. seasonal visa policy means worries for Filipino workers this summer and the American businesses that rely on them. That's coming up next, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Cape Cod here in Massachusetts may be the epitome of American summer vacations, but for many years now, it's foreigners who provide a lot of the service labor in shops and restaurants there. Jamaicans, Eastern Europeans, people of many different nationalities. They come to the Cape each summer on temporary seasonal work visas, known officially as H-2Bs. By the way, President Trump relies heavily on seasonal workers for his Mar-a-Lago getaway. Nationally, one of the largest groups receiving H-2B visas are Filipinos. But this summer, the Trump administration won't be issuing seasonal visas to workers from the Philippines. The World's Jason Margolis has that story.
This is the story of the Tamayo family. They're from the Philippines. Right now, though, they're in Vermont doing housekeeping at a ski resort. They're hoping to shift soon to their summer jobs in Cape Cod. The family has 1 month to get a summertime visa. The clock is ticking. The mother, Yolanda, is making an appeal.
So to the United States of America President, Honorable Donald Trump, please give us a chance to renew our H-2B visas. We did not violate any rule and regulations. So please help us to going back to our summer employer.
That would be the Hot Chocolate Sparrow, a small family-run shop in Orleans, a small city on the Cape. Come summer, the population of Cape Cod nearly quadruples. At the Hot Chocolate Sparrow, lines stretch long for coffee, sandwiches, and ice cream. Owner Perry Sparrow first tries to hire Americans for the summertime surge.
The majority of our workers are American, but there's just not enough. I mean, you have 50-something restaurants in Orleans alone, and they all need workers. There's just not enough to go around.
If Sparrow can prove that he can't hire Americans, he can bring in foreign workers on H-2B visas. He says, frankly, he'd prefer Americans. It cost him a lot to pay for international flights and visa fees for his overseas workers. But he's also found the Tamayo family from the Philippines.
They fly back. The first day they land, they come back to work. They pick right up where they left off. They know, you know, the inventory, where everything goes, where they're supposed to put things away. You know,
this conversation was recorded a year ago when Sparrow and thousands of other seasonal businesses were struggling with a shortage of seasonal visas issued by the U.S. Back then, Sparrow was anxiously waiting to see if he'd win what's called the visa lottery.
It's a tremendous amount of stress.
This year, his stress is through the roof. In January, the Department of Homeland Security said that too many Filipinos are overstaying their visas and are no longer eligible for seasonal work permits. I caught up with Sparrow again via Skype and asked him what he'd do without the Tamayos.
You just feel kind of helpless. Business aside, I mean, it's, you know, it's just unfair for them to lose out on an opportunity when they've done everything by the book. And I mean, it's more than just losing workers. I mean, they're, you know, everyone, you know, all the customers know them here. You know, it's like losing part of your family.
That feeling is mutual. Reben Tamayo, Yolanda's son, has been working at the Hot Chocolate Sparrow for 6 summers.
I really, really like to work there because they are really great. They treat us like a family member. They don't treat us like a only for like employee.
Tamayo is staying in a small apartment in Vermont, along with his wife, parents, sister, and brother-in-law. We sat around a crackling fire as it snowed outside. When the Tamayos found out that Filipinos, along with workers from Ethiopia and the Dominican Republic, are now banned from getting H-2B visas, Rayban says he was shocked.
I feel really sad about it because I think it's really unfair. Being a hardworking person, they need to realize that Filipino people, they are here just to work and not to be doing like illegal things.
But the Department of Homeland Security says nearly 40% of Filipinos overstayed their visas last year. DHS also says Filipinos are using the H-2B visas as a cover for human trafficking. Department officials turned down my interview request. I asked Raven's mother, Yolanda, about the trafficking claims.
We have to respect the decisions of the Department of Homeland Security.
She also says the people involved in illegal activities should be deported, but that her family shouldn't be punished and denied their visas too.
We are trying our best to strictly not violating any immigration law or U.S. government law. So maybe it's God's plan.
If you're going to punish an entire country and the workers who want to come here to make a better life for themselves, I think you're punishing the wrong group.
Daniel Costa is the director of immigration law and policy research with the Economic Policy Institute in Washington.
You're punishing workers from a country because previous workers were trafficked and victimized. You know, the right response is to crack down on traffickers and to better regulate employers and the recruiters that use H-2B and ban the recruiters and employers that violate labor and immigration laws rather than issue blanket bans on entire countries.
Costa says the H-2B visa has a long history of worker exploitation, and structural flaws in the program could be a reason some Filipinos have overstayed their visas.
If they had to flee from an abusive employer, they probably still need to work to pay off the debts that they owe to recruiters.
Seasonal visa workers are tied to their employers. If they're caught in a bad situation, they can't just pick up and switch jobs. Legally, that is. And a path to residency, that is, employer-sponsored green cards, are very difficult to get for lower-skilled workers. So families like the Tamayos from the Philippines are stuck working within the H-2B visa system. Yolanda Tamayo has been going back and forth from the Philippines, working seasonal jobs in New England for 13 years. Her son Raven says that when he was younger and living in the Philippines, he'd miss his mom when she went to work in the States.
I graduated high school, college. She's not with us, only my dad, and it's hard for us.
Now the son is doing the same thing as mom did, splitting his life between the Philippines and the U.S. But he says the sacrifice is worth it. He tells me about working in the Philippines after he finished college a few years back.
And my first job ever in my life is being a janitor. It's really hard. It's in the mall. Per day, I make only for 480 pesos. It's only for $10 per day.
In the U.S., he earns $11 an hour, money that he can send back home to relatives. His employer on the Cape, Perry Sparrow, is working with immigration lawyers and the Philippine embassy to try and keep the Tamayos in the United States. He's appealing for an exception since the family is already here and in good standing.
I seem to be getting different answers, and it's like trying to herd cats.
A DHS spokesperson told me on background that the department will evaluate petitioners on a case-by-case basis, even if they are from the Philippines. The Tamayos have until mid-April to get an answer. If not, they'll have to head back to the Philippines. And coffee shop owner Perry Sparrow will have to figure out how to find enough workers to keep his summertime business running. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
Let me share with you a little preview of a story we'll have on tomorrow's show. It's about the president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, a leader who makes his own rules. His war on drugs has executed thousands of Filipinos without trial. Tomorrow, we'll hear how Duterte's sister explains this.
All I can say is in his heart, he's guided by God.
She compares him to Donald Trump.
They're not guided by Darth Vader. They're guided by the light of God.
How Duterte became Duterte. That's tomorrow here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. When Haiti is in the news, it's rarely a good story.
There's always this kind of implicit assumption that not only are things bad in Haiti, but that, you know, this is just the way things are there, the natural state of affairs there.
This American doctor says to understand the roots of Haiti's problems, know your history. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Protesters have been marching in the streets of Sudan's capital every week for the past 3 months. We're going to hear what one of those protests sounds like in just a minute. The demonstrators in Sudan have a lot on the line. Often they're met with tear gas, police batons, and sometimes with live ammunition. But economic hardship has crippled Sudan's economy. Inflation has skyrocketed. And the protesters say their only hope is to end the three-decade rule of President Omar al-Bashir. Khartoum activist Shiraz Ibrahim has been part of the protests. She says the demonstrations have spread to almost every corner of the city.
I can return to my house randomly and find tear gas, the tankers, right in front of my house. They actually, you know, burned some of the trees of my house. So I'm talking my house from my perspective. It's the live ammunition almost everywhere. Like people, walls now are being, they've been drilled. To
you mean like bullet holes have gone into walls?
Yes, I've got some few of my own, like kind of a small souvenirs right now at the moment.
And this is happening all over Khartoum, like in upscale neighborhoods and in poor neighborhoods?
Yes, all neighborhoods, except the neighborhoods where the government officials are known to be living.
So what does it feel like to be on the streets of Khartoum?
The vibes are very strong. The Sudanese populations have reached to a phase where the fear of losing actually something has almost vanished. And the matters are now beyond hunger. The cause has become like even bigger.
Well, this is what it sounded like on the streets of Khartoum early this week. So, Shiraz, what are people chanting there?
Yeah, they're actually chanting just four, that's all.
Four.
That's the hash line. Does good best is actually, it means just four, that's all, which is the tagline that has been used for this past demonstrations for the past 3 months.
I see. So the government should just fall, that's all we need.
Yes.
So the government's response has been tear gas, sometimes live ammunition, police with batons. This seems kind of risky. Why are you taking this risk?
We've already reached to a phase where the population has nothing to lose anymore. The inflation rate has increased up to the rate of over 70% now. There is no cash in any of the banks. There is the basic needs for actually like food sources or resources. They're all gone. So basically the country is left with barely nothing. So it's either slow starvation and slow death, or death by ammunition. So this is where the people has reached.
Activist Shiraz Ibrahim in Khartoum, thanks very much for speaking with us today.
You're welcome.
Those protests in Sudan are having an impact here in the U.S. among the children of Sudanese immigrants. Hana Baba of station KALW reports from Union City, California.
I can't open this.
It's only 7 p.m., but Seja and Ala Hussein are yawning. They're jet-lagged. They just got back from Sudan 3 days ago. Their parents sent them to college there. A lot of Sudanese expats do that. But then the protests began, and their mom, Fatma, started calling them every day. Seja, she's 19. She tried to calm her mom down.
So I'd be like, oh, mom, there's nothing, you know? But, like, all of a sudden you hear, tra, tra. So it wasn't, the background noise wasn't helping me at all.
Fatma wasn't buying it. She was following the news from California. Security forces were storming neighborhoods in Khartoum. People have been protesting the brutal crackdown, but also inflation, corruption, and devastating poverty. Seja says she joined the calls for President al-Bashir to step down.
There's so many problems that are going on in Sudan right now that makes it seem like we're ignorant if we were to just go to school and complete our education.
But then late in February, government security agents swarmed their university, chasing protesters, tear gassing, and beating students. A weeping student caught it all on this viral video. For Fatma, that was it. She pulled her daughters out of the university and went on Facebook to urge other expat parents to do the same. She says, I felt so angry because I sent my girls to my country, my homeland, to learn many things about the culture, to be with family. But sadly, they had to come back in the end. I'm angry. It's not clear how many international students have left Sudan, but Ala says a lot of their friends did, and it was hard to leave.
I mean, sometimes, you know, I say I really, really want to go back and protest and just be a part of it. Because at some point, this is going to be, you know, our Independence Day, getting from under the tyrant. And this is going to be a big day when it happens. So I do want to be a part of it. But at the same time, like when I go on social media and I see videos, I'm scared to go back.
At this community meeting in Hayward, they're talking about the protests, and the people at these events are usually adults, first-generation Sudanese. It's different tonight.
My generation, our generation, or the generation that's going to change Sudan.
16-year-old Haifa Abu Sheba gets up close to the mic. She slips in and out of Arabic, talking Arabizi, a kind of teen speak.
In the future, maybe not when I'm in Aish, maybe when I'm not alive, but there's going to be a point in Sudan when Marah Tamsik.
It was videos of the protests that sparked Haifa's new activism.
Literally, I would grab my phone and I'd be like 8 o'clock in the morning, running to my friends, like, look what my people do, and it's in Arabic, and they're like, what are they even saying? And I like explain to them. That made me feel like this is my home, these are my people, and I should be proud of them. I should never. They walk the streets and they ask for freedom and they fear nothing.
For American kids like Haifa, the protests are connecting them to their parents' and grandparents' country in a way they never felt before.
Before that, a lot of them had the same sense as me, as there's nothing to brag about or there's nothing to say about Sudan, so we just like claim other things. We'll claim like, oh, I'm just black or I'm just African American. But I feel like throughout this revolution that's been happening, a lot of us have been saying, no, like we are Sudanese people. We stand with the people of Sudan.
As for Seja and Ala Hussein, they're gearing up for the next protest, not in Khartoum, but close by in San Francisco. And they got their chance ready to go.
Hey, Ecos. Bendis Mam Nechaf, Mam Nechaf, Mam Nechaf.
For the world, I'm Hannah Baba.
Honestly, Ahmed Ahmed knows all of them.
Okay, let me take you back to January 2017. That's when President Trump made a comment about a dumb deal in a call with the Prime Minister of Australia. That dumb deal, as Trump put it, was an agreement President Obama made to resettle more than 1,000 refugees who were stuck in Australia's offshore detention camps. The camps are on the tiny Pacific island of Nauru and on Manus Island in Papua New Guinea. Some of the asylum seekers have been there since 2013, because for years it was Australian policy that refugees picked up at sea were sent to those island camps instead of being allowed into Australia. The agreement with the U.S. was designed to get some of the refugees out of their island limbo. We wanted to get an update on what's happened to that agreement, so we asked the world's Carol Hills to look into it. Carol, you've been following this story. What is happening now?
Well, I was curious because it's been a couple years. I decided to find out, well, how many have been resettled in the U.S. from Nauru and Manus. So I got in touch with Anne Richard, and she was Assistant Secretary of State for Population, Refugees, and Migration in the Obama administration, and she actually helped negotiate the deal. The first thing I wanted to ask is, how did this deal come about in the first place?
Well, the Australians approached us and asked if we would take some of the refugees off of these two islands as part of our regular annual refugee resettlement process. And so we agreed to do that, but we also asked Australia in return to take an interest in refugees from beyond the Pacific and the Southeast Asian areas, refugees who were fleeing Central America, refugees in Africa.
So, Carol, has the U.S. taken in any of the asylum seekers who'd been stuck in these Australian-run offshore camps?
Well, they have. Nearly 500 refugees have made it and are resettled in the U.S. But that's out of about 1,200 who were in the camps at the time the agreement was signed in 2016. And I asked Anne to give me a sense of who these people are who've been resettled in the U.S.
Well, I've met a number of them. So, for example, Imran Mohammed, who is a very young man, when he was detained by the Australians, is now 25 years old. He lives in Chicago. He is working during the day and going to school at night. So his days are very, very full. Several of them also have sort of a survivor's guilt of being off these islands and out of detention and able to be at liberty while there are others who are still there.
So how many refugees are left in the camps on Manus and Nauru?
Well, according to the Refugee Council of Australia, as of February 28th, just last month, there are 394 people left on Nauru and 580 on Manus Island in Papua New Guinea. So that's 894 altogether. Also, 265 people who applied to be resettled into the U.S. were rejected.
And why is that?
Well, apparently, when you apply for asylum in the U.S. and are rejected, you don't need to be given a reason why. But many of those rejected, more than half, are from Iran, which makes Ann Richard, the former Obama administration official, think that it has something to do with the Muslim ban by Trump, which in its current form blocks visas from five countries with majority Muslim populations. Mm. And those countries are Iran, Yemen, Somalia, Syria, and Libya.
Carol, I've read about these camps on Manus Island and Nauru, and it's really horrific conditions. I mean, what are the options for the people left in these offshore camps?
It's really grim. I mean, there are still some who haven't yet applied to the U.S. for resettlement, so we don't know what will happen to them. There was an attempt to resettle some in Cambodia. Seven went. It hasn't worked out well, so that's not happening anymore. There was a sponsor group in Canada that resettled another person. And New Zealand, several years ago, put out an offer. We'll take 150 of them. There's elections coming up in May in Australia, and if the government changes, there's a good chance that they would take New Zealand up on their offer. But it's really grim, and plus, the camp in Manus no longer really exists. So the men stuck there, and it is a men's only camp in Manus, they're living in other housing, which the Australian government is providing for, but it isn't set up for long term. And some of them, you know, have been there for like 6 years.
Yeah. And what about Australia? Have they taken in any of the refugees they were encouraged to take in the agreement with the Obama administration?
There were 32 people from El Salvador and 9 from Colombia permanently resettled in Australia in 2017. In 2018, less than 5 were resettled from Colombia, and there's been no resettlements from Guatemala or Honduras, and that's the only data they have.
The World's Carol Hills, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
On this International Day of Happiness, which it is officially, we bring you a service from Chinese social media to help boost your mood. A big trend on the social media platform WeChat is getting groups of people to say nice things about you. Manya Kusa is the editor-in-chief of What's on Weibo, and she wrote about the popularity of these Kwa Kwa groups, as they're known. Kusa told The World's Brandy Fullwood about this kind of self-care that takes the form of compliments.
So what are Kwa Kwa groups?
It is basically online chat groups where people will praise each other no matter what.
And what kind of experiences and compliments are people asking for or talking about?
It could be anything. It could be work-related. It could have something to do with their appearance or their love life.
Is there like an example that jumps out to you?
Well, for example, if somebody says, I've been looking for a job for 3 years and I still haven't found one, then they will always find the positive in what you say. So then they will say, you've been looking for 3 years. That means that you have such endurance. That means you don't give up. So no matter what you say, they will always turn it around and look for the bright side in the story you're sharing.
And this is a phenomenon in China, but there are similar things in English language on Reddit called Toast Me. Do you know where this idea started? Is this just kind of an echo chamber that everyone wants to create?
I think everyone in this social media environment feels they need to be complimented every now and then, especially since it's pretty competitive and everybody's leading their best life on social media. But I think in China, it's a little bit different because you're dealing with mostly a generation that is a one-child generation. They have all of the pressure from their parents and grandparents on their shoulder. So more than what we see in the West, I think these Kwa Kwa groups should be seen in this light of this generation that is facing so much pressure.
These groups are free, right? Are there other ones where you have to pay for compliments?
The first groups that popped up some years ago, they were college-based, so in Chinese universities and colleges all over the country, and they are free. But now lately, you've seen this phenomenon where you can also purchase these services from the big e-commerce website Taobao. This is something that I tried out for myself, and I paid about $7.50 to be praised for 5 minutes.
What did you ask for?
I said that I'd been studying Chinese for such a long time, and that I sometimes still feel somewhat depressed if I really cannot understand the older people in Beijing, especially the ones who are talking with a thick accent. Around 200 people within 5 minutes were encouraging me, telling me, you can do it and you've done it for so long and Chinese is difficult. Even we cannot understand the old people in Beijing. It does give you a good feeling. It really made me glow inside, even though I knew it was a kind of a fake world in a way.
Language learning is a lifelong process, so I also commend you for that effort. That one's free.
Yeah, it is. It is.
The World's Brandy Fullwood there speaking with and complimenting Manya Kusa in Amsterdam. Manya's the editor-in-chief at What's on Weibo, and clearly she and Brandy are awesome. For several weeks, there have been protests in Haiti over corruption, power blackouts, government mismanagement generally. The demands came to a head this week with the prime minister losing his job after a no-confidence vote in parliament. This dysfunction sadly has become, for many, the stereotype of Haiti. What we want to get at right now is why. For an answer to that, it helps to look at Haiti's history. That's something Aaron Richterman has been thinking about for a long time. He's a doctor here in Boston who's worked extensively in Haiti for years with Partners in Health. Aaron, you spend your time between Boston and Haiti. I imagine you see headlines in U.S. media and you get to Haiti and you see perhaps a different reality on the ground. So where is your head at when you get down there? Like, you get off the plane, you go to the hospital. What are you thinking?
Well, you know, as I get there, I'm spending my time in rural Haiti working in a clinic there in a town called Anche. And so I'm heading to a place where, you know, there's a clinic staffed entirely by Haitian healthcare providers taking care of patients with HIV, tuberculosis, and cholera. And you know, hunger is the number one complaint that I see in clinic there, and it often gets directly in the way of being able for them to take their medications and receive their medical care. You know, I think when I returned from Haiti and hearing the questions from people here, which is frequently, you know, things like what's happening in Haiti? What's going on there? And there's always this kind of implicit assumption that not only are things bad in Haiti, but that, you know, this is just the way things are there, the natural state of affairs there.
How do you see these ongoing protests?
Yeah, well, I think it's first important to consider what I think is really the fundamental issue in Haiti, which is that people cannot rely on public infrastructures to supply and support what are the foundational components of a functioning society. You know, things like education, roads, jobs, security, or healthcare, as I work in. And it's essential to realize how this state of affairs came to be. And this is, you know, how I see it. And that first and foremost, the country that we call Haiti was originally conceptualized, you know, 300 years ago as a slave colony powered by kidnapped people from Africa. And the original idea of Haiti was not as a functioning society with schools and hospitals and other pieces of public infrastructure, but instead as essentially a giant plantation, you know, specifically designed to enrich France. And thus, as a direct result of this, you know, when Haiti won its independence, none of this infrastructure was there to begin with. And so you might think, why do these events 200 years ago even matter now? Well, the reality is that since that time, there have been, you know, multitudes of policies, many of them explicitly racist, which have continued to propagate this original historical injustice into the present time. You know, you have France in the 1800s refusing to recognize Haiti's sovereignty until Haiti began paying the equivalent of $21.7 billion over the course of 122 years in restitution for lost property. You have the U.S. invading Haiti in the 20th century, occupying them for 20 years as a result of the debt that Haiti incurred to pay France. And then over the last few decades, you have the view, which in my opinion is justified in many cases, that the U.S. and other powers have continued to tip the scales in Haiti's democratic processes in favor of candidates aligned with the U.S. interest. So this is the lens through which I think my patients see the current protests, which is that, you know, all of these historical events and many more have contributed to the propagation of this fundamental problem.
Connect that history then and the whole current state of affairs to medicine in Haiti right now.
So I think the most dramatic example of this collision of remote and recent history is the cholera epidemic, you know, which in Haiti has resulted in nearly a million cases of cholera and over 10,000 deaths since 2010, both of which are, by the way, probably vast underestimations. And the first question we have to ask is, why is Haiti vulnerable to cholera in the first place? And again, this comes back to the fact that cholera is a waterborne illness that can be basically eliminated with comprehensive water and sanitation infrastructure. And so the answer returns to this lack of public infrastructure to provide clean drinking water. Think about it this way. The average Haitian household is spending 15% of its income purchasing safe drinking water. Second, you can ask directly, why is cholera in Haiti? Well, as we know now, cholera did not exist in Haiti before 2010 and was accidentally introduced into the water supply by UN peacekeepers who were asymptomatic carriers of the disease. Cholera was literally brought to Haiti by the international community. And although the UN has admitted responsibility, there's, you know, a pitiful amount of money that has become available to address this problem. And finally, you know, we have to ask the question, why is cholera continuing to propagate in Haiti? What is continuing to drive, you know, these cases, these deaths? Cholera and food insecurity are closely related. You know, people who are hungry behave very differently than people who are not hungry. And the people who are hungry may be at higher risk of drinking unsafe water or eating unsafe food. And this relationship is important in this specific context because Haiti is one of the most food insecure places in the world. So then, you know, we have to go back to history. Why is Haiti food insecure? You know, you have U.S.-driven changes to the Haitian economy in the mid-20th century to move away from agriculture and towards a manufacturing economy, in part to, you know, by the desire for cheap labor for American firms. And then more recently, you have, you know, the forced tariff reductions of the 1990s, which flooded the Haitian market with American-grown rice subsidized by the U.S. government, and in many cases permanently putting Haitian farmers out of business. You know, when Haitian doctors are working at trying to treat the cholera patients in front of them and treat the annual cases that are coming in with the rainy season, you know, this is the context through which all of this must be seen.
I mean, you mentioned players like France and the U.S., some officials from the U.N. Is it up to them to address these issues and come up with solutions that work?
We'll start with France. You know, I think that the impact of that direct payment to France over the course of 122 years, it's immeasurable in restitution for lost property, which was basically the bodies of the Haitians themselves. And so in my mind, I think there's no question with regard to France that there should be some sort of reparation in response to that. And with the U.S., I mean, the U.S. and Haiti, their fates have been inextricably linked since the birth of both of the countries. And so I think, you know, the role of the U.S. is one to, you know, to acknowledge sort of the ways that we have undermined Haiti throughout history, but also then to serve as a good neighbor, as a support to let Haiti, you know, develop in Haitian hands and with Haitian self-determination.
Dr. Aaron Richterman, thanks very much for being with us. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Richterman divides his time between Boston and rural Haiti, where he works closely with Partners in Health. Our conversation brought to mind someone else whose work serves as a bridge between the two countries. Singer Malu Beauvoir was born to Haitian parents in Chicago. Her childhood was spent in the U.S. and in France, two countries that, as we just heard, have deeply influenced Haiti's history. But it's Haiti that Beauvoir most connects to in her music, singing to her audience and the voodoo spirits in Creole with a disco backbeat. That's Haitian-American Malu Beauvoir and a song called Rassemblement, Creole for Gathering. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.